It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Co-host Veronica Rickert will be back with me tomorrow. Coming up, Wisconsin's Attorney General is weighing in on a gun ordinance in San Francisco. We'll find out why and what's at stake. First, we're taking a look at a controversy at the Toma VA Medical Center. Today, in several newspapers around the state, the Center for Investigative Reporting published a piece showing the number of opiate prescriptions at the Toma VA has more than quintupled since 2004. Apparently, so many opiates are doled out that some veterans, the reporter writes, call the medical center Candyland, call the hospital's chief of staff the Candyman. Here to talk about this report, how it echoes larger problems on a national level, is Aaron Glantz. He's the veterans reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. Aaron, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
So I understand this article has touched a nerve you've been hearing from a lot of people since it was printed. What are you hearing? What are people saying?
I'm having veterans, staff members at this hospital, family members of veterans who have passed on call me, emailing me, often literally crying, so relieved to hear that a veil of silence surrounding a terrible problem of over-medication of our veterans, overdoses, and retaliation against staff at the VA in Toma, Wisconsin, is finally being exposed in the public.
Well, tell us the basics. What has happened since 2004? What kind of increase have we seen and why?
Well, you mentioned it. A quintupling of the number of narcotic prescriptions at this hospital, basically since the chief of staff, David Houlihan, started on the job. This is a guy who was sanctioned by the medical board in Iowa for having an inappropriate relationship with his patient, for taking his patient's medications home with him. Was disciplined by the Iowa Medical Board, picked up, moved to Wisconsin, and very quickly became the chief of staff of the VA hospital in Toma, which serves 25,000 veterans a year, and as many of your listeners know, serves veterans who live in most of western Wisconsin. And once ensconced in that position of leadership at the hospital, began what can only be called a binge of opiate prescriptions, of narcotic prescriptions to veterans, taking the number of oxycodone pills, for example, dispensed, we found in our investigation, from about 50,000 pills a year when he took over to over 700,000 oxycodone pills in 2012.
Well, one hypothesis that might pop into one's head is, hey, these maybe are veterans coming back from Iraq, Afghanistan, wounds, chronic pain conditions. Maybe there's just more need for these medications.
I think nobody's questioning the fact that many people are in pain, many veterans are in pain, but there's nothing to explain tremendous increase in the use of painkillers at this hospital except for to look at the practices of this leading physician and a few of the other people that he worked with. The Inspector General of the VA investigated claims made by many employees that this physician and a nurse practitioner who worked closely with him were basically doping his patients to the point that they would drool during therapy sessions, sometimes fall asleep and burn themselves with cigarettes at the hospital. The Office of Inspector General found that the prescriptions that these two individuals wrote were way out of the ordinary when compared with other physicians at the VA. Unfortunately, or fortunately, just what happened, the Inspector General found no criminal wrongdoing, and so they buried the report. It was never made public until we obtained it, and Dr. Houlihan remains on the job.
You mentioned staff members trying to raise these issues. You talked to some of them, I believe. Has there been any kind of retaliation to whistleblowers there?
There has. I mean, not since our article was just published over the weekend, but over the last few years, a number of employees who tried to raise issues with the staff were demoted, were asked to leave. We talked to a number of individuals who had retired early because they faced a regular abuse from Dr. Houlihan. I talked to a number of pharmacists who were fired when they refused to fill his prescriptions. A real atmosphere of fear and intimidation at that hospital. Many dedicated staff, nurses, doctors, social workers, nurse practitioners who want to help our veterans recover from war, and were, you know, they felt completely intimidated by this chief of staff who was intent on doping his patients and apparently had the backing of, you know, of the federal government in doing so.
And you got a response from David Houlihan, the chief of staff you're talking about. What did he say about this rise in opiate prescriptions?
Yeah, I mean, he didn't really respond to the rise in opiate prescriptions. He almost seemed like he didn't believe that the prescription epidemic was happening. He said that he treats all of his patients individually, that his patients are not complaining, that everything's fine, that the people who are complaining to me are isolated incidents. Then when I asked him about the overdose death of a 35-year-old veteran under his care, he had nothing to say. There's a veteran, 35-year-old former Marine from Stevens Point, Wisconsin, and, you know, he should be alive today, but he overdosed and died in the hospital's inpatient psychiatric ward because Dr. David Houlihan and another physician, Dr. Davis, gave him so many narcotics and muscle relaxants and tranquilizers and then Benadryl and antipsychotics on top of that, that he expired in their hospital of a drug overdose.
Now, you mentioned oversight or lack of oversight at the federal level. The Veterans Administration has gotten a lot of criticism over the last year. I mean, are the problems you're reporting on in TOMA part of this bigger picture that we've been talking about for a while now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the person who initially came to me with concerns at TOMA, Ryan Honnell, I quote him in the story. He is a West Point graduate, a Gulf War veteran. And when Eric Shinseki was forced to resign as the secretary of the VA last year over some of these same quality of care issues, he saw that the new VA secretary, Bob McDonald, a West Point graduate, a former CEO of Procter & Gamble, he felt a lot of hope. He wanted to be part of the change, so he went to work as a scheduling secretary in the mental health clinic in TOMA. He moved from Indiana to Wisconsin just to serve veterans, just to, you know, he just wanted to give back to his country the same way that he was giving back when he was in uniform. And when he got there, he said everything was upside down, and he quit after 2 months filing a whistleblower complaint on his way out. So I think it's fair to say that the reason people in TOMA at the VA are so upset is because they thought there would be change after this national scandal, but that change just simply hasn't occurred, at least in their world.
So who would change come from now that your report is out there, the Inspector General's report, you've brought that to light? Who would have to take action here?
Well, I think that ultimately it's going to be up to the VA leadership. You know, they're going to have to look into this. The VA in Washington is going to have to decide, is this acceptable? You know, is it acceptable that the chief of staff of a VA hospital that serves, you know, a third or half of a state can be behaving in this way? And members of Congress have reacted. Senator Baldwin, Congressman Kind, have both reacted and said they want an investigation. Congress can put pressure on the VA to do something meaningful. But ultimately, you know, it's a federal agency. The Secretary of Veterans Affairs reports to the president. And the Secretary of Veterans Affairs hires the individuals who directly supervise Dr. Houlihan. And it'll be interesting to see. You know, the situation at the VA is that the main criticism that many people have is that there's a lack of accountability, that problem providers are able to act with impunity. And we'll see in the response here about whether or not that's going to be true in this case.
Aaron, thanks for joining us, and I hope we can talk to you again as people start reacting to this story.
All right. Take care.
That's Aaron Glantz, veterans reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. Yesterday was the last day of work for custodians and grounds crew workers at UW-Superior. UW-Superior is outsourcing their jobs as part of a plan to save money in the face of declining enrollment, a tuition freeze, and state funding cuts. Danielle Kading reports on whether it's a sign of things to come.
For 3 years, Jeanette Johnson has been helping keep UW-Superior clean. Now, Johnson says she's ready to make a clean break. She is one of 19 who received official layoff letters on Christmas Eve. Johnson says she's going to miss the people.
I'm hoping that my coworkers and myself will be able to, you know, not just spite this place forever and say, oh, UWS is bad. It's like, well, yeah, a bad thing happened, but life goes on. This is a statewide thing. This isn't going to be the only school. I get the feeling this is just going to snowball.
UW-Superior is contracting with Tennessee-based Service Solutions Company for an annual savings of roughly $350,000. Those who were laid off had a chance to reapply for their jobs with the company. A UW-Superior spokeswoman says at least two custodians accepted jobs. Chancellor Renee Wachter says it wasn't an easy choice.
We're in this situation today, I think, really underscores the fiscal reality that our institutions are facing as these budget reductions are happening system-wide and across the state of Wisconsin.
The legislature has been putting pressure on UW system with $500 million in cuts over the last 4 years and a tuition freeze in the last budget. Governor Scott Walker is proposing to keep tuition frozen. UW System President Ray Cross says they're making adjustments to make sure students get a quality education. Cross says UW Superior needs to submit a plan for a balanced budget in exchange for roughly $2 million from System that keeps them out of the red. Cross says outsourcing is just one way to find savings.
We have to be able to find ways to shift expenses into savings from the back office side, from the non-teaching side, over to the instructional side. We have to do that.
Cross says no other universities are planning to outsource to his knowledge. UW-Marathon County outsourced its campus bookstore and custodial staff last year. Dean Keith Montgomery says there's not much savings in supplies and expenses when 90% of the budget is staff.
It's really unfortunate that, you know, you lose those jobs, but you can say that our core mission is education, and it's unfortunate you'd have to say that we can replace custodians with a janitorial service. It's not impacting the education that we provide to students in the classroom.
But Cross says that doesn't mean staff are valued less than faculty.
What I'm arguing is that if there is no teaching or instruction, there is no one else employed. We have to make sure that the teaching and instructional side and on the research campuses, the research portion, continues to be strong, or we threaten the existence of a campus.
UW-Superior sociology professor Marshall Johnson says faculty aren't immune to financial pressures. He says some are leaving out of fear.
They're putting off things like buying homes, having children. They're pushing everything into the future because of the student debt that they carry. So they have to be very wise in their decisions about where they're going to stay.
UWS junior Preston Fuller and sophomore Stephanie Stetzer say they're having a hard time with the move to outsource staff.
Watching them suddenly get shoved away like they weren't actually worth anything to the actual UW system just felt wrong in so many levels.
Yeah, I agree.
As for Jeanette Johnson, she says she's relieved to get on with her life and leave the whole mess behind. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio in Superior.
An ordinance in San Francisco requires residents to use trigger locks or locked containers for guns kept in their homes. So what's it to us here in the Midwest? Well, Wisconsin's new Attorney General, Brad Schimmel, last week joined 25 other states in support of a federal court challenge to that San Francisco gun ordinance. We've got Adam Winkler with us now to figure out why this local ordinance has such a big national profile and what it can mean for the future of guns and gun control. He's a professor of constitutional law at the UCLA School of Law, and he's the author of the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So on what basis is this San Francisco ordinance being challenged in court?
Well, the San Francisco ordinance requires gun owners to keep their firearms locked, even in their own home, unless they're carrying those firearms on their persons. And a lower court held that the law was unconstitutional. That went on to a federal court of appeals, which reversed that decision and said that San Francisco was within its rights to limit gun owners in this way. Individual plaintiffs are suing, saying that the law really deprives them of their easy access to a firearm at a moment's notice in a life-threatening situation because they don't always want to be carrying their gun on their person.
So the idea being that the Second Amendment guarantees a right to keep and bear arms in part for self-defense.
Well, the Supreme Court in a 2008 landmark decision known as District of Columbia against Heller held that the Second Amendment does protect an individual's right to have a firearm for personal protection, and that any law that denied a person the ability to have access to a handgun in the home for self-defense was an unconstitutional burden. In this case, San Francisco is claiming it's not such a big burden because we have this exception. If you're carrying your gun on your person, then you can use it for self-defense, and it doesn't have to be locked or kept disassembled.
So you mentioned local plaintiffs. They're the people who originally took this to court?
That's right. This was by plaintiffs and some gun rights organizations, a sheriff's group. They've argued that there are times in their home when they don't want to be carrying their firearms, such as when they're bathing or when they're sleeping, but they're still concerned about self-defense. They want to be able to have a firearm nearby that's not locked that they can use. They argue that the problem with the trigger lock is that in a moment of life-threatening emergency, the stress is very high, and your small motor functions become very difficult to use effectively. And so you might not be able to get that trigger lock unlocked and thus might be injured.
So are you surprised now that a bunch of state attorneys general, including ours here in Wisconsin, have joined in the legal challenge to this ordinance?
Well, it is somewhat unusual for other states to join in a lawsuit dealing with an ordinance that they don't have any semblance of in their own states. But nonetheless, it's become much more common, especially at the Supreme Court level, to get groups of states on board to file amicus briefs arguing one way or another. In this case, the states allege that they have an interest in seeing to it that the law of the Ninth Circuit doesn't become influential in other circuits and affect how the Second Amendment is treated elsewhere. So it's unusual, but not it's becoming more and more common.
Now, where exactly is this? You mentioned the Ninth Circuit ruled in San Francisco's favor. Is this a case where they're trying to get the plaintiffs are trying to get the U.S. Supreme Court to take this up?
Indeed, the plaintiffs have sought review in the United States Supreme Court, and the recent amicus brief signed by 26 states, including Wisconsin, basically a brief to encourage the Supreme Court to take the case, saying that this is a case of significance, of great importance, and the court should take this case. It comes on the backdrop, though, not just of gun lock regulations, which are pretty rare, but really about a larger controversy over the scope and meaning of the Second Amendment. The Supreme Court's decision in 2008 left the lower courts with a lot of open questions, and a lot of courts in the subsequent have really upheld most forms of gun control laws. So I think that there's a big effort to get the Supreme Court to take another gun case so that they can clarify exactly what the Second Amendment means.
Right. It seems as though the core issue here is how much right does a local government, maybe even a state government, have to set regulations on firearms?
That's right. That's the big question. We know that you do have a right to bear arms, but look, the history and tradition of guns in America is also a history and tradition of gun control. We've always had gun control in this country going back to the founding fathers, and the Supreme Court recognized as much in the 2008 Heller case. The question is when does gun control go too far? And the plaintiffs in the San Francisco case say this is a perfect example. They have some precedent on their side. That 2008 Supreme Court case, one of the laws that was struck down was a storage requirement that required people to keep their guns locked up or disassembled. Slightly different law than the San Francisco law, because it doesn't have the exception for carrying your gun that San Francisco has. But nonetheless, there's a lot of people who feel that this court will have a lot of interest in taking this storage requirement.
Now, you mentioned that Washington, D.C. ordinance that was struck down went up to the Supreme Court, that the brief from the attorneys general mentions that as a comparison to saying, hey, that was struck down, so should this. Are they fundamentally similar?
Well, what's similar about them is that in Washington, D.C., the law required you to keep any firearm that you had in the home. You weren't allowed to have a handgun, only a long gun, but you had to keep it locked or disassembled. And you could only unlock it or disassemble it for certain recreational purposes, but not for purposes of self-defense. San Francisco has learned the lesson and says, look, we want you to keep your gun, in this case handguns, locked up and or disassembled, and you can keep them on your person available for self-defense as long as you are carrying it. You are in control of it at that very moment. Then you can have it for self-defense. So that is a big distinction between the D.C. law and the San Francisco law. Whether it's enough of a distinction to survive in the Supreme Court remains to be seen.
Maybe a dumb question here. Is it relevant that Washington, D.C. is in effect federal territory and San Francisco is part of a state? Does that matter for the precedent there?
Well, it doesn't technically matter for this precedent. It did matter at one point. It matters for some purposes of constitutional litigation, but it really won't matter in terms of the court's view. Well, the court has interpreted the Second Amendment to apply equally to the federal and state and local governments. As a result, any law that's unconstitutional in Washington, D.C. should be unconstitutional in San Francisco.
We're talking to Adam Winkler. He's a UCLA law professor and author of the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. We're looking at this federal legal challenge to a San Francisco ordinance that requires trigger locks or locked containers for guns stored in homes. Wisconsin's attorney general joined in saying the ordinance should be overturned. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Should local governments be able to set their own regulations on firearms? If so, how much latitude should they have? Do you see an ordinance like this one as a threat to Second Amendment rights elsewhere around the country, maybe here? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host, Veronica Rickert, will be back with me tomorrow. We continue our conversation on local gun regulation in the United States. There's a legal challenge in federal court to a San Francisco ordinance that requires residents to keep their guns locked up when they're at home or use a trigger lock. Wisconsin's new Attorney General, Brad Schimmel, joined his colleagues in 25 other states in support of that legal challenge. They're hoping that the U.S. Supreme Court will take this up. UCLA law professor Adam Winkler is the author of the book Gunfight, and he stays with us, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Should local governments be able to regulate firearms? If so, how far can they go? Do you think requiring gun safes or trigger locks in the home is a good idea? Is gun control, on the whole, in retreat in the United States? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Adam Winkler, before the news, we were talking about why other states might be interested in this, worried about this. Is there some way in which this local ordinance in San Francisco could become precedent and somehow apply to states or local governments, even if they don't want it?
Well, what the states are saying is that they have an interest in protecting the fundamental constitutional rights of all citizens, and that if the decision of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is not reversed, it will set a precedent which could influence policy decisions and court holdings beyond the city of San Francisco and beyond the Ninth Circuit. And so at the Supreme Court level, they really want the court to come in and provide more clarity and strike down San Francisco's ordinance to make clear that the right to bear arms is so strong that state and local governments can't impose these kinds of restrictions, such as trigger lock requirements.
Let's go to a caller at 800-642-1234. We have Mike on the line in Waseca. Mike, hi.
How are you doing?
Good. What do you think about this?
Well, I think it's all kind of crazy. If somebody breaks into your house and... You know, I'm all about safety. You know, if you got kids in your house, yeah, you should have some kind of, you know, have the gun up somewhere where kids can't get at it, all that kind of stuff. But if somebody breaks into your house, and you got to fumble around for 5 minutes to try to find a key for a trigger lock, or a combination, or whatever, you're going to be dead by the time you get your gun. It kind of defeats the whole purpose of self-preservation in your home, doesn't it?
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. And Adam, that's kind of the argument from the NRA and the plaintiffs and the attorneys general who are supporting them, that the gun lock, the trigger lock, defeats the self-defense use of a firearm.
That's right. And, you know, there is some evidence to back that up, in the sense that we do know that in high-stress situations, it's very difficult to dial a phone number, even if you know that phone number very well. And presumably, when you're unlocking a trigger lock, it's going to be the kind of thing you've never done before in a high-stress emergency situation, and you might be nervous and do that as well. Of course, it does raise an additional question, which is, if we don't trust someone and their small motor skills in an emergency situation, why are we allowing them to have a gun to shoot and kill other people? But I guess the Second Amendment in some way answers that question for us. We have a right to bear arms, and we have to take that right seriously. And if this law does restrict people's ability to defend themselves, then it goes too far and will be held to violate the Second Amendment if the Supreme Court takes that case.
Mike, thanks for the call. We'll go to Anthony in Sparta. Anthony, hi.
Hello.
Hi. What do you think of this?
Well, I just had a comment or a question. How would that ordinance in San Francisco be enforced, or is it enforceable?
Anthony, thanks for the call. Adam, I think I had read that there were some gray areas in how exactly this kind of ordinance is enforced.
Well, exactly. I mean, if we think about the crime being having a gun in your home that's loaded and unlocked while you're not carrying it, when would the police ever find out that you've done this? Imagine 99.9% of the incidents of this occurring would not be discovered by the government and would not be the subject for prosecution. I guess where it could come up, though, it could come up if there is an accident. If you do leave your gun unlocked and someone gets a hold of it and uses that gun, then it could be a basis for showing that the homeowner maybe was negligent, maybe even be the occasion for an arrest of the gun owner if someone else uses that gun for criminal or accidental purposes.
Or I suppose it could be a secondary enforcement sort of thing where if you were, you know, your house was searched for a drug-related charge, say, and they found an unsecured gun along the way, that could be an additional charge.
It could be an additional charge. It's the kind of thing that will only come to the government's attention if it's caused some kind of problem or there's some other problem, like you say, some kind of unrelated drug offense that leads police into the home. So the vast majority of cases, it wouldn't be enforced against anyone.
Anthony, thanks for that question at 800-642-1234. Adam, big picture, I mean, is gun control pretty much on the retreat in the United States between legislatures reluctant to pass new gun control laws and courts ruling on the side of gun rights for the most part?
I think it's actually a much more complicated story. I think if you look at the federal government and the Obama's post-Newtown proposals, it's easy to come to the conclusion that gun control is completely stalled in America. However, if you look at the state level, it's quite a different story. You've had significant new gun control laws adopted in states like New York, California, Maryland, Connecticut, Colorado. So you've seen some significant movement in favor of stricter gun control laws across the country. I think it's more fair to say that the gun debate has just heated up, and because it's a hot debate, neither side is really going to win it outright. And the story in the courts is much the same. Here's another case where the court has upheld a gun control law, this trigger lock requirement, despite some powerful arguments on the other side. As a result, it's hard to conclude that the right to bear arms is winning all the time and gun control is always losing.
And when states like New York pass those laws, how do they make sure they're more or less bulletproof, if you'll forgive me, for legal challenges?
Well, they bring in lawyers, and they have consultations, and they have their own lawyers on staff that look at these things, and they try to figure it out. One of the difficulties here, though, is that the Supreme Court really has not provided enough clarity for the lower courts. And so the lower courts have had to sort of grope along kind of blindly trying to figure out exactly what the Second Amendment allows and what the Second Amendment does not allow. And it's really one of the reasons why we really need the Supreme Court to step in and provide clarity. Ever since Newtown, however, the Supreme Court has seemed kind of reluctant to step in. They've had good gun cases presented to them every year in the last couple years. They've refused to take them. It'd be interesting to see if they take the San Francisco gun lock ordinance.
That's interesting. You hear sometimes about the Supreme Court, even when they do take on cases, sometimes trying to interpret them very narrowly to the facts at hand and not create a wider precedent. Has that been a trend even when they do pick up gun cases?
Well, that's what happened in the Heller case. The Heller case in 2008 said that there was a right to bear arms, but didn't say exactly how lower courts are to sort out which gun control laws are constitutional and which gun control laws are unconstitutional. And so the court took a narrow approach in that case, sticking to the facts. However, what it did was encourage hundreds of lawsuits across the country challenging any number of gun control laws, and the lower courts didn't really have answers from this narrow ruling about how to decide these cases. So sometimes the court really wants to rule narrowly. Other times the court really has to step in and provide clarity, otherwise, because it's invited a lot of litigation, and the lower courts don't know what to do.
Back to our callers now. We have Brett on the line in Wauwatosa. Brett, hi.
Hi. I was curious as to how are they defining that the gun is disassembled? For example, in the case of a semi-automatic gun, would just simply having the magazine out be enough to be considered disassembled because the magazine is a part of the gun?
Brett, thanks for the call. Is that a gray area in this San Francisco ordinance, Adam?
You know, I'll be honest with you. I don't know if it's a gray area in the ordinance or a gray area in my own memory of the ordinance when I looked at it. I believe that the guns must be locked if they're a handgun, and so I believe it must have a trigger lock. But, I could be wrong about that. So the caller makes a good question, one that I should maybe double-check.
Now, looking around the country, Adam, and I'm sure you are, this is an issue you track, are there other legal challenges that we should be keeping our eye on that may be important precedents for the future?
There are a number of major cases. The biggest open question in the gun control movement, really, is whether states and local governments can limit people's ability to carry guns in public. You know, San Francisco's trigger lock ordinance is pretty unique. Not a lot of cities or states are going to adopt laws quite as broad as that. But a lot of states have laws on the regulation of carrying firearms in public. Supreme Court's really provided no guidance on that whatsoever. And the lower courts have gone different ways, including a California court here, the same federal court that ruled in this gun law case, went the other way and said citizens must have the right to carry guns in public. So that's the biggest issue on the Supreme Court's Second Amendment docket.
Well, I'm sure we'll talk to you about that sometime, Adam. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Adam Winkler, professor of constitutional law at the UCLA School of Law. He's the author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Quilting may be centuries old, but artist Leah Evans makes quilts that are far from traditional. Inspired by maps, aerial photography, satellite imagery, and microbial images, Evans creates textiles that explore the relationship between people and the environment.
Physical maps, like actual discarded maps from UW sometimes, and the few times that I fly, I've just sketched as much as I could looking out the window, and some of them are just completely made up and just kind of based on imagery stored up or just an idea of a type of landscape and just kind of go from there. I think most people like maps and loved looking at maps as a kid. I worked for the Park Service for a while and did some navigating in Lake Superior at Isle Royale National Park, so that kind of, I think, fed into it. But I was also studying textile design at KU, University of Kansas, and took a class on environmental history. I think I took the class thinking it was a natural history class, and so it wasn't quite what I expected, but just kind of opened my eyes to a lot of ways that land affects people and people affect land. And that really got me thinking of visual ways we represent land. There's so many steps that happen before I even start a piece, so I acquire fabric in a lot of different ways. I use a lot of secondhand fabric, sometimes clothing that I take apart, and then also upholstery fabrics, and I dye a lot of the fabrics and just kind of don't limit myself to any specific thing. So a lot of just working with the color initially and then cutting and sewing and embellishing with embroidery. And with the few pieces I've done based on Wisconsin, they kind of deal with agricultural issues. So I have one that's my interpretation of what cranberry bogs look like from above, and a lot that are just based on fields and kind of the shapes of boundaries. This piece is a newer one that is based on agricultural land around a river, so shows strips, piece strips of fabric kind of coming off of the river, like rays. There's a French word, arpent, for that type of land division, where everybody gets a narrow strip coming off of the river, so you get the bottom land, the more fertile land, and then access to the river as well. I've been doing a lot of pieces based on the Mississippi. I like spending time on lakes and in lakes, but rivers kind of have more of a character and more movement and more of a story for me. I think the agricultural imagery, like dry farming and then the pivot irrigation, interests me. And I just, yeah, I like the Midwest. I think I'll probably, it will always be my home. And I think the quilting kind of fits into my idea of the aesthetic of the Midwest.
Leah Evans is a textile artist based in Madison. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television. For more info, visit wisconsinlife.org. Well, let's learn more about modern quilting. We have Wendy Franzak with us. She's former president of the Madison Modern Quilt Guild. She's here in the studio. Wendy, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So what's the difference between a traditional and a modern quilt style?
Well, typically a modern quilt is inspired by modern design, so you would see it in a more contemporary home where a Civil War quilt may not fit in quite as nicely. You'll see in some cases a lot of negative space, maybe bold colors, a little bit more use of solid fabric versus prints, and there might be some improvisational piecing where things aren't quite as straight. We call it wonky. So,
is that a technical term?
I think it's a technical term. So things aren't quite as precise looking, but they still take a lot of time and love to create.
Now, when did this kind of modern quilting come into existence?
Well, modern quilting has really been around through most of the 20th century. Like, for example, Gee's Ben's quilts, I would call that modern quilting. But it really exploded when Martha Stewart had Denise Schmidt on her show in the late 90s. And she came out with an excellent book, Denise Schmidt Quilts, in 2005. And Weeks Ringel and Bill Kerr came out with an excellent book called Quilter Studio in that same time. And it really exploded in blogs and Flickr especially. And it really took off from there.
And is there really a super hard and fast distinctions? One person is a traditional quilter, one's a modern, or do some people play back and forth and maybe even mix styles?
Yeah, it really varies a lot from quilter to quilter. I think a lot of my personal work is more like fresh traditional, where it may be considered modern because of the colors being used, but I might use a lot of traditional blocks. But yeah, everyone has their own unique voice when it comes to quilting, just like modern art.
Well, quilting is really interesting because in some ways it's a solo gig. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, there's this community of quilting. What's our quilting community like here in the state?
Yeah, we're really lucky. We have a really strong quilting community, especially in Madison. We have both the Madison Modern Quilt Guild, which I'm a member of, and the Mad City Quilt Guild. And we get together and sew, we get together and show our work and get inspiration from each other. We also have Quilt Expo in September, which is
huge.
Huge. It's the Lollapalooza of quilting, where thousands of people come from all over the world to see quilting, buy quilts, and show their quilts.
And then I see quilting at county fairs, at state fair. Do we see modern quilts in those kind of settings?
Yeah, we're starting to creep into those areas. There's about 35% of the quilting market right now is modern, and we're starting to see even more than that in our local quilt shows.
Now, you mentioned Flickr, and the first reaction might be quilting and social media, traditional, modern, but has social media changed the world of quilting?
Yeah, it absolutely has. The Flickr group, Fresh Modern Quilts, really expanded modern quilting exponentially. That's where people could get together and see each other's work, and it's exploded from there. Instagram in particular is really huge. That's my favorite place to get inspiration. Facebook, blogs, yeah, social media is definitely influential in the spread of it.
So how does it, do you put, as you're working on something, maybe works in progress and post them up on social media?
Unfortunately for my friends and family, constantly. Yeah, on Instagram and
another
Facebook.
Another quilt.
Yeah, another cat or quilt on Wendy's Instagram. Thanks.
Cats and quilts.
Yes, cats and quilts.
But is the cat a challenge? I mean, because I could see a cat really doing a lot of damage.
No. They're your favorite buddy in the quilt shop or in the quilt room.
With the resurgence in handmade artisan items, right, people like buying local and handmade things, is there a bigger audience to maybe you want to buy a handmade modern quilt?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of local quilters that sell. My friend Nikki Ross sells her quilts on Etsy. Absolutely. I have nothing more to say.
And what kind of things inspire your patterns, your designs? We heard in that Wisconsin Life piece of being inspired by looking down on Wisconsin's landscape. Where do you look?
Yeah, that was really interesting. I've seen a quilt about the Great Lakes, too, which I found very inspiring. I like to look to some of the great quilters like Jackie Gehring or Weeks Ringel for inspiration. Just improvisational piecing where you're kind of making your own fabric as you go along, I find very inspiring. Maybe modern art in some cases, and just looking at the quilting community in general for inspiration.
No, when I think of quilting, I think of, you know, some math in there, and you got to come in with a plan and know what's going to fit where. And you're saying improvisational. How does that work?
Yeah, that's kind of, some people are into it, some people are not, but for the math part, I'm not always the best at. So with improvisational piecing, you don't have to cut quite as precisely or even sew as precisely in some cases. I'll definitely get some flack for saying that. But for me, it's more freeform sewing.
But you still end up with a rectangle. You're not, because I would end up with like little triangles poking out all over the place. Well, three-dimensional weirdness.
Yeah, three-dimensional weirdness, exactly. That's where rulers and rotary cutters come into place. You can square things up with that at the end.
And another thing I think of with the internet is it's got to open you up to having a lot more resources in terms of your fabric selection. Even either you're going on and ordering yourself or your local quilt shop has access to more fabrics, maybe from around the world. Is this true?
Yeah, actually, I just purchased some fabric from England this week. But we do have a lot of really awesome local quilt shops like Stitcher's Crossing or Millhouse. But there's a lot of online resources where you can buy quilt fabric from Japan or any of your friends on Instagram. Even you can buy fabric.
What got you into quilting?
I really needed a need to create. I was working about 50 hours or so a week, and I really just needed something to do that wasn't a responsibility involving my family or my work life. So I just searched around for a quilt shop that had a class that met my needs, and I found one.
What's the easiest way? Say somebody's thinking, yeah, I'd be into this. I don't want to put a lot of money into it up front in case it's my thing, not my thing. What's a good entry-level way to get to taste quilting?
Yeah, it can be definitely expensive to get started. I would recommend either a class through your local quilt shop where you can borrow supplies, or Madison College even offers sewing machines that you can use during their quilting classes.
Seems like just finding a friend who quilts and being their co-pilot for a little bit. And do people do that? Do you kind of apprentice and watch how it's done and then figure out how to do it?
Yeah, absolutely. And people come to the Madison Modern Quilt Guild to learn, too. And they can do that at our sew days.
Now, you mentioned a couple famous quilters when you go to the ginormous quilt expo here. Do you get to meet some of these legends in the field?
Yes. Well, Nancy Zeman does quilt expo here, so we're really lucky for that. But yeah, that's one of the most exciting parts, to meet the quilt rock stars, like we call them.
Okay. I got to know what you're working on. How many projects do you have in progress right now?
At least six.
Six?
Yes.
Okay.
I have 10 completed, six in progress.
And what's your favorite one? What's the most fun one that you wish you weren't talking to me so you could be working on it right now?
Yes. I will leave the studio and work on a modern quilt inspired by Jackie Gehring. It's improv, gray and white. I hope to have it in the Sun Prairie Quilt Show.
Okay, gray and white, improv, what kind of patterns will we look like? When we see, or what
think
like?
Squares with white sticks in it. Doesn't sound too amazing over radio.
Well, send us a picture.
I will. Thank you.
Well, Wendy, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
All right, thank you so much.
That was Wendy Franzak. She's former president of the Madison Modern Quilt Guild.